of Virginia, and also the director of the Project on Live Theology. Charles is the author of numerous books, including the award-winning God's Long Summer, Stories of Faith and Civil Rights, and Strange Glory, A Life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and I believe he's got some copies there for purchase if you'd like to pick up a copy of Charles's biography of Bonhoeffer. Not long ago, he published a memoir, entitled Evangelical Anxiety, and he has recently published a monograph on theology and biography titled Resisting the Bonhoeffer Brand, A Life Revisited, which was published in April 2023. Today, he's going to be speaking to us about Bonhoeffer's letter from a Gestapo prison, and he's titled his talk, Waiting with Christ in Gethsemane. So without any further ado, please help me welcome Charles March.
Thank you so much. Thank you so very much for this kind invitation. It's a joy being back at St. Paul's, though I come on Sunday nights, sneak in to the 7:30 service. For that lovely time of prayer and meditation. I'm reminded this morning, nonetheless, of all the extraordinary exchanges and events that the project, thanks to the kindness of St. Paul's, has convened in this space over the years. I moved down from Loyola College in Baltimore in 2000, and joined this esteemed faculty, featuring, of course, my dear friend over here, Larry Bouchard, who I'd known both as a grad student and would know as a beloved colleague. And one of the goals of our work was to create these spaces where academic scholars and theologians can sit down at tables with pastors and practitioners and learn from each other. And in this room and in your lovely sanctuary, the faces of Jürgen Moltmann and Heidi Newmark and Timothy Gurringe and John DeGruchy, the great South African theologian, Cheryl Sanders and Sung Chong Ra, John Perkins, so many others have transpired in these rooms. So it's lovely being back here once again. So it was the beginning of 1933, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer was still enjoying the long Christmas break from the university. Having moved back into his parents' house on Wangenheimstrasse, he worked every morning from his bedroom, his notes carefully arranged on the oak writing table that had been his desk since boyhood. With a westward view of the neighbor's frozen garden, he wrote lectures and sermons with the familiar economy of effort, though now with the aid of a new Alder, his first typewriter. "I have finally entered the technical age," he told his good friend. So it's afternoons were set aside for naps, meetings with friends over coffee, writing letters. Weather permitting, there was skiing on the well-marked trails of the Grunewald. Most evenings, he went into the city for a concert or a play. Musical nights at the Bonhoeffer's home continued a pleasant Saturday ritual. During a short stay in Friedrichsbrunn, where the family had a country house, Bonhoeffer lolled about reading Heine and Hegel. On January 30th, on the very day that Bonhoeffer's Genesis lectures had turned to the story of Cain, second son of Adam and Eve, who jealously murders his brother Abel, to become the first destroyer of life. On that day, the unimaginable happened. Stormtroopers appeared in the streets, bearing their hideous rubber truncheons, their drums and flags and armor. And Adolf Hitler, a German citizen for less than a year, was appointed by President Paul von Hindenburg as the new Reich Chancellor. Nothing would ever be the same in the wake of that, not the world of the mind or the world of politics, not Europe or the world outside it, Bonhoeffer's life was now set on a collision course with Hitler's. By the end of April, just a few months later, 1933, Bonhoeffer had made his first defense of the Jews and condemnation of the Aryan clause, alerting a group of ministers and theologians to Berlin to his conviction that against the rising German anti-Semitism and brutality, the church would not simply need to bandage the victims under the wheel, but to smash the wheel itself. And by the end of the summer, the churches had become Nazified, the theological faculties, baptisms were now phrased so that the child would grow up to honor not only Christ but the Führer, and to be conformed in his image, etc., etc. The Nazi Church worked very hard to convince the nation, and did so, that ultimately Christianity had nothing to do with Judaism, and that in Jesus Christ, God had disinherited the Jews of their ancient covenant, and that even Jesus himself was not a Jew. I began working on my biography, Strange Glory, in the spring of 2007. I can't believe it's been that long. During a semester when I was invited... Wow. I was going to talk about Bonhoeffer and intimations of the holy everywhere abounding. I'm sorry we couldn't coordinate that a little better. during a semester when I served as the Dietrich Bonhoeffer visiting professor at Humboldt University in Berlin, I know it's a fancy title, but the post came without a salary, without a housing allowance, without travel, I think. But I did have a cozy office on Bergstrasse, right across the Spree from the Berlin Dome. And soon enough, I made my first trip to the city library, where this treasure of new Bonhoeffer papers. Yeah, I had to show you the library. I'm such a nerd. But that's where I hung out. Had just been received. And thanks to the kindly assistance of the director of special collections, and often in books and projects like this, directors or assistant directors of special collections are like the heroes, so the real heroes of the story. I gained access to the newly obtained Dietrich Bonhoeffer archives. Well, some of you may be asking, who's Dietrich Bonhoeffer? who was Bonhoeffer? He was a Berliner, a theologian, an aristocrat, a bon vivant, a saint, if a saint, certainly a dandy saint, and a conspirator, executed on Hitler's orders for the crime of high treason and in the concentration camp in Flossenbürg on the morning of April 9th, 1945. Bonhoeffer is the rare genius who reconciles in thought and character the twin ideals of beauty and justice. And his thought crosses boundaries so freely, boundaries of genre and culture and audience, sometimes quite thrillingly, while also remaining generously, exuberantly Christian. Bonhoeffer would tell you that first and foremost, he was a follower of Jesus Christ. His more popular books you may know, Cost of Discipleship, Life Together, these works make biblical faith intelligible to believers and non-believers alike without reducing, complex theological and doctrinal ideas to cliches. I cannot agree more wholeheartedly with the British ecumenist and theologian Keith Clements, when he says that Bonhoeffer belongs not first to church history or to the Christian camp, but to the human race, standing as he does among those who represent the further and deep possibilities of the human spirit. So in the city library, the singularities of his life just unfolded daily to me in this series of journals and photos and bits of papers and letters and the like. And suffice it to say, an intriguingly different image of the man began to appear before me than the one who had been the subject of my 555-page doctoral dissertation, which may still be in the bottom of the Shannon Library with the $50 bill I put in it, you know, in the spring of 1989. And I felt the gentle nudge into biography. I found a registration paper for a new Audi convertible that Bonhoeffer's father had bought him when he began to organize an illegal underground seminary in the north of Germany. I love the idea of this Protestant monastic director driving his brothers around Rugen and the Baltic seaboard in his new Audi convertible. As a bank slip from a joint account he shared with his best friends. There were a lot of files on race relations in the United States. He had spent a year here. He would spend a year here. There were inventories of his library, of his wardrobe. There were austere landscapes that he had taken of photographs of North Africa. Polaroids of his travels on the road. Pictures of Dietrich and Eberhard, his best friend, making funny faces and goofing around on their vacations together. There was even a postcard from Texas, several postcards from Texas, and a correspondence with Mahatma Gandhi, all parts of the mosaic of a life. And his is a remarkable story, born into privilege and a family of prodigiously talented humanists. By the age of 21, 22, this golden child of the Berlin Grunewald had already written a doctoral dissertation that would be hailed by the great Karl Barth as a theological miracle. And by the age of 25, he had completed his second doctoral dissertation, in which he set out to deconstruct the Kantian Germanic tradition of transcendental subjectivity. Self-confidence, let's just put it like this, was not in short supply in his own self-understanding or in the Bonhoeffer family as a whole. But, and you may resonate with this, he would never be content in the library and in an academic life alone. But unusual still for a German of his generation, not only a scholar, but a German of any sort, he felt this uncommon kind of constitutional hunger to see new places and to experience life outside of the privileged circles of the Berlin Grunewald. He, in fact, would say yes to almost every invitation that came his way to leave Germany in the next years. He would travel widely and whenever possible. And between 1924 and 1932, he journeyed to Italy and Libya, to Morocco, France, Scandinavia, to Cuba, Mexico, to the United States, and as we'll see presently, to Spain. Bonhoeffer had an insatiable kind of desire to break out of the sort of predictable trappings of his upbringing, and a great restlessness. You can see this in his journal entries when he's talking about how suffocating he feels by the trains and the buses and the kind of flattening sort of effect of of, I don't know, superficial culture on Germans. You can see this in his writings. And in fact, you can follow, I think, the arc of his restlessness from the earliest years of his student life and teaching all the way to a Gestapo prison where he was incarcerated for his role in this conspiracy to assassinate Hitler. And you can see this arc of restlessness kind of moving through his life all the way to the experience of writing in some of his last manuscripts about what it means to abide with Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. I would like to suggest that in some ways that restlessness finds a still point and a kind of a homecoming, if you will, in that image of the Christian life as a waiting with, abiding with Christ in the garden. But that's just a thought for another time. The question that drives me still in my classrooms and seminars and in this book and with you today is, how did Bonhoeffer see so clearly, so early, the rising specter of German anti-Semitism and state brutality against undesired peoples as the great masquerade of evil? How did he see, you know, within months of these new alliances and laws, that not only was a brutal and monstrous nationalism sort of at play, but also apostasy in the churches was running rampant. You know, what were the sources of that imagination, of that moral and spiritual imagination? How did he see? What made it possible for him to see clearly? The answer to questions like this, it's a question I've asked in so much of my writing throughout the years. You know, what makes certain people evil? And, you know, you can look at some of my work on the civil rights movement, where I try to understand the claims by Ku Klux Klan leaders to be ambassadors of God in preserving the sovereignty of the sacred South, and so on and so forth. But the answer to such questions about Bonhoeffer, and about the sources of character and conviction, you know, would need to draw on many aspects of his past, of his family, of many influences. In asking about Bonhoeffer, for example, about his capacity for ultimate honesty and civil courage, we would want to consider his family. His family that embraced high-minded sort of liberal virtues of, you know, humanity and toleration and beauty and justice. We would want to take note of his erudition, of his patriotism. But a certain kind of patriotism, an honest or critical patriotism, which reminds me that Donald Shriver once spoke in this church, the dean of Union Theological Seminary, and a good friend of ours, on his book, Honest Patriotism. We would have to take note of Bonhoeffer's cosmopolitan sensibility, of his deep ecumenical and global ties. And perhaps above all, attend to his deep and indefatigable devotion to the Jesus who was born homeless in a manger and to the essential Jewishness of the Christian religion. I would want to add to this something about the provenance of curiosity and openness. These virtues that enabled him to freely and happily put himself into unfamiliar spaces, into places where he might see intimations of the holy abounding everywhere, or intimations of Christ among the margins, in the streets, among the poor, among the unfamiliar. And I think that when I try to explain this question, I also take note of something Bonhoeffer said late in prison, when he was thinking back on precisely this kind of question. And he was in a letter to his best friend, Eberhard Baecke, he wrote, "You know, Eberhard, when I look back on my life, I really only see two times when I underwent deep transformations of character and kind of spiritual vocation. The first was under the deep impression of my father." His father was the head of the psychiatry clinic at Berlin University. He was a brilliant empirical scientist. And the second were the impressions from my first journeys abroad. It was then that I began to make the turning from the phraseological to the real. Don't you love that? Under these impressions, it was then that I began to make the turning from the phraseological to the real. And what I'd like to do in the few minutes we have remaining is give you a glimpse into one of those moments of turning from the phraseological to the real. And this comes from one of my favorite chapters in the book. The year after Bonhoeffer finished his first doctoral dissertation, he said yes to an invitation to move to Barcelona. He had been abroad before, but he had never lived anywhere for such a long period of time, and this would be a one-year commitment. So he said, "Yes, I'll come down and help as the assistant pastor of the Lutheran congregation of the city." And already from the start, we see little tensions and conflicts breaking out between as a matador. Between the expectation of this kind of very firm, straight arrow, by the book, a Lutheran senior pastor who wanted to run an orderly congregation and preach pure Lutheran doctrine, and Bonhoeffer, who is time and again late for business meetings, forgetting his duties because he's out in the streets looking at all of this novelty and theater, which for him brings spiritual, new and fresh spiritual energies. So if you'll indulge me, 2.5 pages from, a chapter called Greetings from the Matador. As Lent came to an end, see, that's the tie-in. As Lent came to an end, Bonhoeffer would be sure not to miss any of the Spanish Holy Week. His Barcelona letters and journals paint a portrait of the young theologian as an exuberant and wide-eyed pilgrim. After Easter and Pentecost, there would be the astonishing bustle of the Corpus Christi feast, the celebratory adoration of the Holy Eucharist, with confetti, paper serpents, and wailing instruments, and parades of giants waving grotesque flags as they danced and begged for alms. Everywhere, people rushing about, creaking and squealing with their noisemakers or with their own voices. There were processions of local dignitaries, civil authorities, clergy and choir boys, of the military and its marching band, of recently confirmed children in white bridal gowns that set their dark faces quite apart, and of other children costumed as saints, Joseph, or the Mater della Dolorosa, the Mother of Sorrows. There was a figure of Christ with a crown of thorns bearing the cross, and following behind a whole host of small angels, then Saint Anthony, then an ancient hermit. Then the monstrance arrived, the ornate sunburst in which the Eucharistic host is kept, and everyone, priests, soldiers, angels, giants, entire families, went down on their knees until the vessel passed by. Then suddenly, paper serpents and confetti again swirling from all directions onto the sacrament. And the archbishop strode placidly through the crowd. Another military band followed in the rear, bringing the procession to an end. If you can recall, the Protestant reformer from Wittenberg, Martin Luther, after one of his visits to Italy, referring to the Pope and the Vatican as a heap of dung, the contrast to this young Lutheran is quite striking. Bonhoeffer followed the parade all the way to the cathedral, where a larger crowd gathered in the piazza in the twilight for the benediction of the Blessed Sacrament. There he beheld a scene so genuinely rare and beautiful that he felt transported, he said, to a period 500 years ago. The choir boys stood in their crimson robes under flickering lanterns. Alongside them, infantry and cavalrymen, resplendently uniformed with large, fantastic, warrior-like knights' helmets, and people wearing multicolored garments. When the priest and monks, together with their pupils from the collegiate school, entered in radiant white robes through the mighty main portal of the cathedral, the monstrance was at last returned to its home on the altar. In that unique illumination of lanterns and torches, as a breeze stirred the canopy over the bishop and everyone knelt within the church and outside, Bonhoeffer had another intimation of paradise. Corpus Christi lasts 8 days, so I'm hoping to see more, he wrote in a letter home. At the end, he would say, he felt as if a theology of spring and summer, I love this, was replacing the old Berlin winter theology. For the pageantry of sun and sea and spangled sky described a new field of vision. One day, standing on his balcony, it occurred to him that he had reason to ask whether Bart could have ever written in Spain. In any event, the more elemental existence steadily worked its magic on him. My theology is becoming more humanistic, he would conclude. And if his thinking about God was being stretched and shaken, certain habits of mind didn't change at all. He would continue to cajole his parents for money. To college friends back in Germany, he would still boast of his popularity with the younger set, his prowess on the tennis court, and the decadence of Mediterranean life, in which he indulged, he said, within acceptable limits. Though telling one acquaintance, I hardly drink anything but wine. To another, he allowed that he spent most of his day in the bathtub. And in conversation with his mother, he still fretted mightily over his wardrobe. He needed, this is funny, so funny to discover this. He needed studs, he said, for his dress shirts. And he could use some new shoes, a couple of extra pairs, in fact, because, as he said, the general view is that one needs a lot of shoes here. He needed some sports shoes suitable for the summer weather. He had been shocked, he said, to realize that he had forgotten to pack his mountain outfit. He also needed new tennis whites and six pairs of crew socks of the same color, his club's rules requiring one to play completely in white. At the same time, the year in Barcelona inevitably expanded his moral imagination. Covetous of finery, though he may have remained, he judged himself now ever more sensitive to the plight of those who really are in need and cannot be adequately supported. It angered him to see his supervising pastor speak gruffly to a poor person who had stopped by the church asking for help. Beyond the comfortable sphere of the German colony, in neighborhoods to the south and directly east, on his daily walks or in the cafes, or in the course of some pastoral effort, Bonhoeffer discovered a different cast of characters. He would describe them vividly and with tenderness of heart, these women and men with whom, at one time, he would have never exchange even a single word. In this way, he met vagabonds and vagrants escaped convicts and foreign legionnaires. He met German dancers from the musical reviews, lion tamers, and other animal trainers who have run off from the Corona circus during its Spanish tour. There were German-speaking misfits, among them contract killers, wanted by the police. All of them had heard of the sympathetic Berliner and sought him out for counsel. Bonhoeffer grew to enjoy their company, too, the criminal types, the little people with modest goals and modest drives who committed petty crimes, and those driven by wild, wayward passions, the real people. And the stories they told, vivid and honest to the last detail, gripped him with a blunt force, as of the gospel's concern for the least of these, his brethren. These people labored more under grace than under wrath, Bonhoeffer was sure. And they were a lot more interesting than the average church member. In a letter to a friend, a former classmate in Berlin, he described himself as learning to accept people the way they are, far from the masquerade of the Christian world. As his society became more capacious and broad, he also discovered a larger and more varied inner world that he, once the hothouse flower par excellence, could come to feel so truly at home in a strange country speaks to transformations both within and without. May God in his mercy lead us through these times, but above all, may God lead us to himself. Thanks.